Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
If you're thinking, I should go for a run today, but it looks like it could rain, Sierra says save on epic rain jackets. If you're also thinking, but I can't go out in these beat-up old running shoes, Sierra says save on top-brand running shoes. And if you're still thinking, but I'm also busy performing brain surgery, well, then we say, you really should have led with that. Sierra, let's get moving to your local store, like now. Go!
In this ad for the Mobil 1 brand, I have 30 seconds to remind you about your first time driving. Remember the feeling? The freedom? How the world felt bigger and smaller at the same time? Because you were in the driver's seat. The truth is, driving never changed. You did. You got a job, a phone, and then a phone that was also a computer with emails that could find you anywhere, and then you were trapped. But here's the good news. It's never too late to break free. Mobil 1, for the love of driving. Visit loveofdriving.us/radio to learn more.
Hello, and welcome to the BBC Gardeners World magazine podcast, brought to you by the team here at the magazine. Join us as we chat all things gardening with the nation's favourite experts. Have you never gardened before and aren't quite sure where to start? Maybe you're new to the whole thing and just finding your way, learning as you go. Perhaps you've had some successes, but a few failures too, and aren't really sure why. Do you find the prospect of gardening a bit daunting, but exciting too? Hello, I'm Kevin, and today I'm chatting to the nation's head gardener, Monty Don. We've all got to start our gardening journey somewhere, so I'm keen to learn what Monty has learned over the years and the wisdom he'd share with those who are just starting out. I began by asking him simply, why should somebody give gardening a try?
Well, the why is very interesting because it will afford them a lifetime of satisfaction and enrichment and enough frustration to make the rewards all the more valuable. It'll be incredibly good for them. They get them outside. It's good for their mind and their body. There's been lots of tests done that the older you get, that gardening combines with it stretching and lifting and pushing and pulling, and you know, all that is very good exercise. With our gym-obsessed culture, actually gardening, it turns out, is probably as good for you as anything else. But I think probably the single most important thing is that, particularly in the modern world, it will connect you to the natural rhythm of life, which I regard as being literally essential. I don't think you can live a good life without that. So it's not the only way, but it's one of the best ways, and certainly one of the most accessible ways, for anybody to tune in to what's really happening. And what's really happening is to do with the seasons, and it's to do with the rhythm of growth, and it's to do with weather, and it's to do with all the creatures that we share this world with. And also, the final thing, which I think, again, is severely underestimated, not least by the British horticultural community, is it's an incredibly creative thing to do. It's artistic. You know, gardening certainly can be art, often is art, and I think always should be art. And whether that's a window box or a sort of large landscape project. So that sounds like a pretty good bunch of reasons.
It certainly does to me. I mean, I would imagine that most people, they've probably got one of two start points. One, I want to make the space just outside my back door look a bit more attractive. It's a mess, so I want to sort it out. Or two, I really fancy growing something to eat. So those are, you know, very sort of tangible, direct benefits. But it's interesting, everything you've talked about is so much bigger than that. I can't imagine that people that are thinking, oh, maybe I'd like to garden, would think, actually, it can do so much more for me than just tidy up outside.
Yeah, I mean, the practical side of it, the tidying up outside, the growing some veg or some herbs, that's not to denigrate it at all. Those are good reasons. But, you know, the more I garden and the older I get, the more important the philosophical reasons and the spiritual even reasons and the cultural reasons and the artistic reasons are. And all the process, for me anyway, are means to that end. The process is in itself enjoyable. I mean, I often think that gardening is the cooking and the garden is the eating. And that, you know, for a lot of people, the cooking is almost more enjoyable than the eating. There's no need to separate the two. You know, they're both valuable. But I think if the British, as a sort of gardening community, have a fault, is we tend to set too much store by the gardening and not enough by the garden. In other words, I don't think it terribly matters how you get to where you want to go, as long as you get either there or somewhere interesting. And we can get very hung up, I think less so. I mean, I think it's getting better, but certainly we have been in the past very hung up on the right way to get where we want to go, or even the right place to go to. You know, the whole thing becomes very prescriptive and it can put people off. I think if you're starting gardening, that is a real discouragement. As if you feel you've got to learn Latin names and you've got to learn when to prune and you've got to learn how to prune and you have to almost take exams to qualify you to just get out there and, as you say, tidy up your backyard, grow a few bits and pieces to eat.
I imagine if you take a real, real beginner, someone that's never done it before, they might actually be feeling a little bit daunted. You know, where do I start? What do I do? What do I tackle first? I mean,
well, if they're not daunted, then they're in real trouble.
I'm guessing you know, when you're on the road doing your tours at gardening shows or whatever, you get all sorts of questions and things from people that are just starting out. I mean, in your view, if someone's thinking, right, I'm going to do it, what's the first thing they should do?
Well, the reason I'm pausing slightly is because there is a correct answer to that. But it's not a very encouraging answer. And the correct answer is take stock. Don't rush out at all. Just have a look. See what's there. See where the sun rises. You know, look and see what's there. And if you're a complete novice, you almost certainly won't know what it is. Find out what it is. So if there's, you know, a large lilac growing or some roses, to a gardener, that's going to tell you something. Or if there are rhododendrons and heathers and azaleas, and you know where I'm coming from on this. In other words, your soil is going to dictate what you can grow. And so if you rush out and think, I want to grow, you know, my mum always had heathers and you've got a garden with a chalk just a few inches under the surface or azaleas, whatever it might be, you're going to cruising for a bruising. So the first thing that you really should do is look. Just look and see what's out there. Because I think the real novice will barely have noticed. It's just outside. In the same way, if you ask people what type of trees were in their street, a lot of people wouldn't be able to tell you. So just trees, you know. Whereas actually what sort of trees they are is quite significant about lots of things, about how they grow, when they grow, what the soil they grow on, so on and so forth. So take stock. Having said that, I think it's nice to be a bit more proactive than that. So I think, if you're in an urban environment, which most people are, a very good way to get going is simply make a raised bed, particularly if you want to grow something edible. And by edible, it could be anything from rosemary bush to parsnips to gooseberries to potatoes. Make a raised bed, and it could be very basic. It doesn't have to be even a permanent raised bed. Put some soil in it, and if you've got soil in the garden, great, or you can buy bags of soil, and either sow some seeds or buy some plants from a garden centre, some lettuce plants or young plants, and plant them out. Now, and water them in and see what happens. Because once you start
to grow... You never know, do you?
No, exactly. Once you start the process of growing, you then become part of that process. And until you are part of the process, you're not gardening in any way, shape or form. If gardening is something that happens out there, beyond and without you, then it's a bit like in the same, you know, my relationship to atomic physics. I know it's out there, but I'm afraid I'm not contributing very anything at all. Or, you know, again, the cooking analogy is make something. I mean, we all started, I remember cooking with my mother and it was pretty disastrous, but it felt fantastic. So grow something, and it's not a bad idea to start with something to eat. But if you love, for example, I think actually you can pinpoint it more down. Find out what means something to you. It could be food. It could be because you like cooking. It could be a certain rose because it reminded you of your mother or your grandmother or whatever. It could be a patch of grass because you like kicking a football about. Make a lawn. I mean, you know, why not? It's all gardening. Find out what means something to you and then think of the gardens, and that might be a little patch of rather dark concrete yard. Think of it as your space where you are going to express what you want in it. And there will be limitations. You know, if you've got a small concrete yard, you are not going to be able to make a football pitch. But, you know, you might be able to grow a few things and work on from that. And just accept that it's a long game. It's not a makeover. You know, it's a commitment that can be as much or as little as you want, but it's not going to go away. It's for life. You know, I don't know about you. I've never met anybody who took up gardening, gardened, and got into it, and then decided, nah, not to do it anymore.
No.
I've never met anyone who gave it up.
No. Once it gets under your skin, that's it, isn't it? You know, you're absolutely passionate and dedicated to it. And I also don't know many gardeners, you know, with you saying, talk about the long game. I don't know many that say, that's it, it's done.
No.
Gardening's done, is it?
It's what non-gardeners say. You say, when will it be finished? Or it'll be lovely. I mean, it's what my mother-in-law used to come and look at Longmeadow in the early days. You know, the first 5 years or so, I said, well, it'll be nice when it's done. And quite rightly, it used to annoy me. Because it's not, you know, 31 years later, it's not done.
No.
And it never will be.
There's something quite liberating about that, actually. And I think quite exciting, too.
No, but I think that goes back to what I was saying about the rhythm of that. You know, this is... It's always been true, but it is more true now than ever that we are losing our connection with the true rhythms of life. And they're becoming artificial. They're becoming artificial through light, they're through information, through you and I now are talking through a screen and we're hundreds of miles apart. You know, how extraordinary is that?
Incredible, I know.
Even 10 years ago, we would have thought it was crazy. When I was a child, it was literally the stuff of science fiction, you know. So we need to get back to that thing where you need something in your life that is a lodestone, is true and is trustworthy and is reliable and is real and is tangible. And I think gardens do that very well indeed. I mean, an awful lot of people I speak to about their garden, what they're really about is going home in the evening. They've had a terrible day. They're tired. They're fed up. And they just go outside and they breathe for a few moments. And they notice that the tulip has opened out. Or that honeysuckle. For the first time, they catch that whiff of honeysuckle in spring. And that's enough. That's all you need. That's it. That clicks the switch back to sensible, back to reality. And it's hard to... explain that, it's hard to explain the power of that until you've experienced it. So, but once you have experienced it, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
I know exactly what you're talking about because I'm thinking about a day in the Gardener's World office and the commute home a couple of hours on a busy train, etc., etc., you know, and then just the wondrous feeling of stepping into the garden, possibly with a glass of wine. Just absolutely perfect. Yes.
I mean, even I... You know, I think people have this idea that I spend my entire life out in the garden, occasionally joined by a film crew who simply follow me for an hour or two. And you know, actually, most of my working day is spent at this desk, either writing, which I do a lot of, or dealing with stuff, you know, coming in. I mean, preparing each programme takes hours across lots of days, you know. This morning, one of the things I did was write out a plant list for more plants for the mound. So I went through all the pale yellow and blue plants. That took an hour and a half, just drawing up a list of plants. So actually to go outside when it's all done and just have the place to yourself, even if I just walk around, or more often than not, I might just go and do a bit of watering or just weed or plant out a couple of things. It's all really low-key stuff. But that is why we garden. It's not the big dramatic thing.
In this ad for the Mobil 1 brand, I have 30 seconds to remind you about your first time driving. Remember the feeling, the freedom, how the world felt bigger and smaller at the same time? Because you were in the driver's seat. The truth is, driving never changed. You did. You got a job, a phone, and then a phone that was also a computer with emails that could find you anywhere, and then you were trapped. But here's the good news. It's never too late to break free. Mobil 1, for the love of driving. Visit loveofdriving.us/radio to learn more.
So let's imagine another scenario. Somebody has got their little courtyard. They've decided that they're going to build their raised bed and off they go. Stuff will probably go wrong, won't it? Somewhere along the line, and that's okay.
The only certainty is that most things will go wrong. And it's more than okay. It's actually the best thing that could happen to you, because going right is rewarding. You know, you grow a lettuce, you either buy a plug or you sow a seed and it grows, and come the day you harvest it and you eat it, and it's the most delicious thing you've ever eaten, it's the cleverest thing you've ever done, and it's gold stars and high fives all round. But you actually have learnt very little about growing a lettuce, because it's happened despite you. Or if not, that's maybe a bit harsh. It's happened without your input, other than the bit of watering. But if you buy a lettuce plant or sow a seed and the seed gets eaten, or the seedling gets eaten, or it gets mildew, or it gets sort of lettuce root aphid because it's dry or whatever it might be, then you're going to learn about growing lettuces. Or your spacing is not right. You know, all the different things that you need to know in order to do it really well can only come through failure, because then you will challenge it. And I remember many years ago, I mean, God knows, 45 years ago, I was writing a book about professional gardeners, because I was aware at the time that there were a lot of men in their 80s who had been head gardeners, who were the last generation who'd come through the pre-First World War training. They'd all been born sort of round about in the 1890s, 1900, and they had trained as very young men in the old pre-First World system, and was fascinating. And, do you know, about three or four of them said the same thing to me, and it really struck home at the time, was that I didn't learn how to garden or sometimes how to do X, Y, or Z until it went wrong. And particularly when I thought I knew. You know, I thought I could grow dahlias. I thought I could grow mushrooms. I thought I could grow vine, you know, grapes. And this is all gardeners in the big house. And then a disaster struck. They got mildew or they got eaten or whatever. And then I really had to think about it and inspect it, and not just repeat what I'd always done, but really start to work at it. And it's like sportsmen. If you're an incredibly talented cricketer and you naturally just go out and score runs, you don't actually get much better until one day you come against someone who gets you out all the time. Or perhaps another analogy is if you play the guitar, if you learn how to play one song and then play it all the time, you'll never get any better at the guitar, however brilliantly you play that one song.
Of course not. No.
You know, you've got to do what you don't know how to do in order to do it well. And that's true of gardening. So going wrong is great. Going wrong is how you learn. Going wrong happens to you. It happens to me. And it will happen to me and to you in the coming weeks, probably.
It absolutely will. And I think also it makes when things do work, or something does grow, or you do have a breakthrough moment, or you grow that thing that has been elusive to you for so many years, that makes it even more magical, doesn't it?
It does make it more magical. And I think also there is another side to this coin, which goes back to really what I was saying earlier about our obsession with process. There are no gold stars for growing something very difficult unless you absolutely love it and want it. You know, it's just as rewarding at every level to grow something that you just chucked in the ground and it grew and was beautiful. It's not about you and your skill. It's about the end result and how it happens. And I think that, you know, in time, you're inevitably going to do both. But I'm all for the line of least resistance. I mean, we have a complete philosophy in this garden here, which is based, the saying we have is, if it doesn't want us, then we don't want it. In other words, some plants are not going to grow in your garden for all the skill in the world. So don't waste time and energy lavishing 80% of your time on the 20% of the things that don't really want to grow in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, I think that also, that realisation comes with a little bit of experience as well, doesn't it? I mean, I've been in my garden for 10 years now, and I haven't listened to my own advice or all the things that we've been printing in the pages of the magazine for however long. And only now am I starting to think, do you know what? I should just give up on that. It doesn't want to be here, exactly as you say.
Yeah. And sometimes there's no logic in that. I mean, for instance, I can't grow a maple to save my life. And yet there's no logic in that. You know, there are plenty of other people in this area that grow wonderful maples. I could give some intelligent and informed reasons why that might be the case. But it doesn't really make sense.
No, it doesn't. And you know, it's just occurred to me, I've never seen one at Longmeadow. No, I hadn't realised until now.
As we speak, there are three in the garden looking pathetically bedraggled, which I've tried again last year, you know, and I bought quite expensive plants and planted them. And for some reason, I suspect we're too wet. It's the main problem, and poor drainage and you know, we have cold winds and things. But even so, there is always going to be something that for whatever reason you can't grow, even if your next door neighbours, your family, your friends, they're all doing it without batting an eyelid. So going back to the original, so for the novice gardener, the first timer, don't be put off by failure. Embrace it. Failure is your best friend. And don't be put off. Don't be too proud to accept that some things will remain failures. There are things which actually are not going to work for you. It's not going to happen. Move on.
Yeah, quite. Okay, now, I'm interested to talk about, well, seeing gardens and gardening as a list of jobs. I know that I think probably many, many beginners will think, well, I've got to tackle the weeds. I need to make sure the lawn is cut. I need to sweep up that or tidy that. And I think possibly a sweeping generalisation, but I imagine someone that is brand new to gardening might think, right, I'll be able to buy something that'll sort that out. And, you know, there might be a temptation to reach for a chemical, a spray or something to deal with that. And I know we both feel very passionately about not doing that. I don't know if you could explain why.
Well,
that's so important.
It is really important. I mean, these are very, very big questions you're asking. There are no easy answers to this because, as you know, I've spent a lifetime dealing with this and so have you, and there will be others and other lifetimes. But I think that question comes in two halves. The first is this idea of jobs and tasks. Behind that lies the idea that if you do those jobs and tasks, you will solve the problem or complete the state. And sometimes that's the case. So, for example, if I want my lawn to look nice and freshly mown, I've got to mow the grass. If I want this path to be swept, I've got to get a brush and sweep it. So rather than, I've got to mow the lawn, I've got to sweep the path, think of what you're trying to achieve and what is necessary to get to that point. Certainly, that's how I go about it. So if, you know, for example, I really like clipped shrubs and shapes, but I never say, right, I'm going to spend, it's time that I went and did some clipping. You know, I need to spend the day clipping or I need to go pruning. You prune entirely for a reason and for a result. So that sort of, that mindset should be behind everything you do in the garden. Why am I doing this? What am I trying to achieve? And if so, is this necessary or the right way or the right time? So that's the easy bit. As to the solving the problem of the terrible unknown thing that is eating your precious plant that you've bought or is, you know, this white mold that's all over the plant, or for some reason your leaves are curling up and what have you, and you've written there's a spray which basically says bug killer, you know, it's snake oil, will kill, solve all your problems, will kill all terrible fungus and what have you. There are two analogies, I think. Is one, you wouldn't go to a chemist and saying, I'm feeling a bit under the weather. It says, well, look, just take anything random from the shelves and inject it into you or swallow it. You want to know what it's going to do, why it's going to do it. You know, you don't take an antibiotic if you've got a bruise. You don't rub arnica into your skin if you know, you've got internal hemorrhaging or whatever. So it's the same with a garden. It is extraordinary how blindly people, and you must get this all the time, I certainly do, you get letters saying that my tree is, the leaves are curling. You know, I've sprayed it with a fungicide, and I hope that's killed the bugs. Or I've seen ladybirds on my tree, and so I've killed them, because are they eating my apples? Ladybirds don't. Where do you begin? Turn on the grown-up bit of your brain. If you're old enough to hold a trowel, you're old enough to actually work out what's going on. You know, stop being so pathetic and just cravenly stopping thinking about it. That's the fierce answer. And the more encouraging answer is everything is connected to everything. You can't isolate it. You can't get a blunderbuss to kill a fly without collateral damage. And that we know, for example, that fungus is absolutely essential for life. No plant can grow without fungus, which is not to say that all fungus is good, but it certainly is to say that most fungus are not bad. So unless you know exactly which fungus you're killing, don't use a fungicide. Likewise with aphids. You may see aphids. A good example would be broad beans. You and I have probably fielded hundreds of letters and questions how to get rid of black fly on broad beans. For those who have never grown broad beans, round about the end of May, early June, almost all broad beans will show an infestation of little black flies, aphids they are, at the tips of the growth. And this is because the life cycle of that particular aphid appears when you get this very fresh, soft, new growth, sappy growth, and they feed on that. Now, by then, most of the flowers have formed, and the aphids don't eat the flowers. They don't damage. The only damage they could possibly do is stop the formation of new flowers. But actually, it's very rare for them to attack growth until it's formed. So the actual damage to your crop is minimal. That's number one. And two, all you have to do is remove the top soft growth, literally pinch it off with your fingers, and that's it. They've got nothing to live on. So they move on. Job done. The other thing, which, and I think the really encouraging aspect is that most novice gardeners are somewhere between the age of, let's say, optimistically, 18 to 38, although it's actually more likely to be sort of 28 to 38, but let's say it's younger. They are of a generation that is much better informed and much more aware of the subtlety and delicacy and interrelationship of the natural world, and that you can't, on the one hand, say, isn't that thrush lovely? And on the other hand, zap the slug or the snail on the path. You know, they're connected. So be holistic, except that for everything that is predating on your plants, there will be a predator for that. For every predator, it needs prey. So if you get rid of all your prey, you're not going to have predators. And when they come back, it's a problem. And finally, I told you this was a complicated long answer.
It's quite all right.
What we do, I mean, my whole approach to organic gardening is the solution to most problems is to put all your energy into growing really healthy, strong plants. And the healthiest plant is the one that adapts best to whatever circumstance it finds itself in. So it's not necessarily the biggest. It's not necessarily the most productive. It's not necessarily the one. I mean, if you sow a plant, two plants, one in very poor soil and one in very good soil, the one in very poor soil might well be more healthy than the other one because it's adapted better and it's worked out how best to do what it does, which might be produce flowers or fruit or seeds or whatever. And as a gardener, that's your main job. Your main job is to provide the circumstances in which a plant can be its best self in that situation, not by a yardstick defined that you look out on the internet or you read in a book or you see at Chelsea, because those will be different circumstances. And I think that's quite a tough lesson to learn, actually. I think that's quite hard to really understand that. I visited a garden in Spain last autumn, which was on a hillside in the Duares district, which, when I visited it, looked completely blasted. I mean, they had planted 15,000 plants and were propagating more to put on, and they weren't doing any watering at all and no feeding at all. And they were just, really, it was an experiment to see what would grow in that incredibly harsh environment and what would survive. If you see pictures of it in spring, it's really full and rich, and it goes through and it is building up. But clearly, compare that to Sissinghurst or compare it to a Chelsea garden, and it looks rubbish. But actually, in the context it's in, it's really interesting and good. And I think that's true of every back garden everywhere, is there is, in the end, your little space, and I don't mean that in a derogatory way, I mean your own little corner of the world is unique. And that's another thing that makes gardening so wonderful, because everybody has their own unique space.
There's something that you said just a little while ago about, you know, a younger generation of gardeners. Certainly I've experienced it. We're seeing it at the magazine, and when we hear from our readers, we know that actually there is a big swathe of younger people gardening, which is fantastic. We're thrilled about that. I wondered, what about the really young gardeners, the children, the grandchildren? You know, how, I know you've have grandchildren now. Is there any interest in gardening there? Is it something that we should try to foster? Or?
Well, it's funny. My experience, I mean, with my grandchildren, they like, I mean, essentially they play in the garden, and they, you know, they have little play spades and things, and they love it. They love running around, they love the flowers, but they're not gardening, and I wouldn't want to make them garden, and I didn't make my own children garden. My experience is that with children from the age of about 5 to 10, you're pushing at a very open door. They like it. They're good at it. It's fun. They love growing things that you can eat and then eating them. They share it. It's almost an entirely successful enterprise, particularly if you do it in a school environment, actually, rather than home. It works incredibly well at schools because it's fun. It makes learning fun. Whereas at home, it's a much more intimate thing. It tends to be something that you do with a grandparent or with a parent, and you do a bit here and there. The really tough age group are 11 to 21.
And I've got one of those.
Yes, I've had them. I have two theories about this. One is that we are quite good in this country at getting primary school children gardening. There are a lot of gardens and a lot of very good primary teachers, and as I say, you're pushing it an open door anyway. And so when they, particularly boys, they go to big school, they're 11. Gardening was something that kids did. Gardening was something that the 5, 6, 7, 8, 9-year-olds did, and they want to be seen as, they're a big boy and girl now. They don't want to be seen as a little kid gardening. That's childish stuff. So it's not cool. And it's not a good way to earn your spurs. And let's face it, going to big school is a frightening experience. So you don't want to do anything that makes that worse. So that's one theory. And the other theory is just simply hormonal. There are other things to think about at that age, you know, and gardening can go on the back burner. I mean, I used to garden when I was a teenager, and I didn't know a soul who did as well. I mean, other than my two brothers, because we did, as a family, we were brought up doing it. It was just not part of the vernacular. And in fact, even in my 20s, I didn't really know anyone who gardened. I mean, obviously, if I'd come through a conventional sort of done a gardening course at horticultural college or gone through parks or training, then, of course, you do mix with a peer group. But because I didn't go down that road, I very rarely met anyone. And thinking back on it, we were talking about this last summer, the first person of my age who I met, other than Sarah, who was interested in gardening, was Tom Stuart Smith, who I met in London when we were both in our 20s. You know, we didn't know many other people. So that I think it's really quite tough for that age group. My own theory is back off and let them find the world. And then there is the other problem, and this is almost much more serious, is that when I started, when I was growing up, I got my own house in my 20s. And that was very normal. Not everybody, but certainly to either rent or buy somewhere. It was modest and it wasn't great, but it had a small garden and I could dig it up and I could plant things and I could do things in it. Now, how many 20-somethings have their own house and garden? It's my children now all in their mid to late 30s and they're only just getting their own house and garden.
It's a challenge now. It really is. It's very, very difficult. And I think possibly if, you know, there might be a greater chance of renting than buying, but then that poses and presents its own problems and questions around what do I do with this garden and shall I put the effort in or not?
Yeah, I mean, you might cut the grass, you might make a raised bed or sow some very elementary veg or herbs, but you're not going to plant any trees. You're not going to be putting in hedges. You're not going to be digging it up, even if you were allowed to dig it up, which you probably are. So I think that's changed a lot. But on the plus side, that age group is precisely the age group that are very aware of the issues of climate change, the issues of plastics, the issues of what our water, of the environment, of nature in all its forms, and all that feeds into the garden. You know, the garden is a portal to reach those issues. Whereas, and you, again, you must get this on the magazine, invariably, if I talk about climate change on Gardener's World or on one of the other programmes I do, there will be some comment from someone of my age group saying, oh, no, not going on about climate change again. You know, let's just talk about gardening. Let's not just bang, you know, constantly hitting me over the head with this. It's about time we did some proper gardening, as though the two things were separate.
Mm.
But, of course, they're not. They're just not.
Not at all.
Even if you want them to be, they're not. Whereas nobody under 40 would ever say that.
Which is encouraging, as you say. You know, that's exciting.
And, you know, what I feel very profoundly is that my age group and myself in particular, because I have such a privileged position, really need to help people coming through to get the same rewards that I've had, the same pleasures. And actually, it's not just a question. I mean, obviously, I can do that by instructing. I can write books, I can make programs, I can say, you know, answer questions. But actually, it's more than that. You need to say, well, okay, how are you going to interpret the world to make the most of this? Because you're not going to be able to do it like I did it. You can't go and buy a house. I got a mortgage at the age of 26 because my brother-in-law played golf with a bank manager of the mortgage company.
That just would not happen today, would it, in a million years?
It was crazy. The mortgage, I can tell you, was for £15,000, and my parents didn't speak to me for 6 months because they thought it was so irresponsible.
Wow.
Different times.
Completely.
Different times. You know, yeah. And so that what I have to do, and I think you, in your position, we have to work out ways of the most appropriate way of getting people into gardening. It's not enough to tell them how to take a dahlia cutting. If you've got nowhere to grow dahlias, it's not enough to say you should plant your potatoes at Easter if it's snowing or it's flooded because of climate change.
Yeah.
And so we're dealing with all these problems. Now, I know for a fact you are dealing with them and so am I, but we're all struggling. I mean, none of us know what we're doing. We're trying to find out. So the interesting thing for me is not so much what I can dispense on high about the techniques of gardening, you know, the actual details, which I can do in my sleep. And then, oh, look, I've got a little dog here. Come here. Good girl. What? It's more a question about the conversation, about what they are telling me and what I have to learn and how I have to change and how we as the society of mankind can learn from each other and make beautiful gardens and productive gardens and all the rest of it. And the British gardening establishment in particular and the British character in general is shy of those sort of grandiose approaches. We feel a bit sort of awkward with it and that we're getting above ourselves a bit and let's just get down to brass tacks. But we have to do it. We have to do it.
Yes.
And it's both daunting and fascinating, I think,
thinking actually about brass tacks a little bit, I'm just thinking, well, it was what you said about, well, go and plant your potatoes at Easter, and you might not be able to do that for some reason or another. And there are many barriers for people that are setting out on their gardening journey. And at the magazine, we often look at them through two lenses. One, I don't have very much time, or the other, I don't have very much money. So how can we make gardening accessible for people that are time or money poor? And it can be done, can't it? It shouldn't be a barrier wholesale.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in some ways, not having very much money is less of a problem than not having very much time. Because even though they've got a lot more expensive, seeds are still relatively cheap. You can take cuttings. You can take divisions. If you know somebody who's got some snowdrops, they could divide a clump and give you some and you're away. Then you've got some and you can divide those. Plants are relatively easily propagated. That's one of the great secrets and the joys of gardening, is you make your own plants. And obviously you have to learn how to do that. But as you know, it's not difficult by and large. And it's incredibly successful. The other day I was looking at, we were replanting in the cottage garden. And last autumn, I dug up a clump of hardy geranium, Roseanne, and divided it up into as many pieces as possible. And I've got 48 pots of that geranium from that one clump.
Goodness me, wow.
Because I just kept every little bit that had a root, just potted it up and left it. And it was pretty insignificant. And they're small. I mean, they're only little plants. But I know they'll grow and they'll be fine. Now, that's extreme. But you could still, it's incredible how quickly one plant becomes four, and then four plants become 12, and 12 plants become 40, and, you know, it multiplies very quickly. So that's the first thing. If you haven't got money, you can make your own plants, you can improvise. There are fabulous gardens being made by people using found objects, by reclaimed material. You know, they're growing things in old shoes and cans and hats as containers. And that is about creativity and invention. Which is not to say that it isn't a limit on to what you can do. It's nice to be able to spend money in the garden and buy a lovely rose or buy a small tree or something, which, you know, is going to cost you anything between 30 and 70 quid, depending what it might be. In terms of time, it's actually more difficult, because if you haven't got much time, you're going to have to, A, cut your cloth accordingly and not do things, and also work out what's more important and what's not. I mean, certain plants, you can cut corners. If you're propagating, that takes time. You have to sow the seed, you have to thin them, you have to prick them out, you have to pot them on, you have to plant them out, you have to water them in, you may have to water them later on. So you learn to grow certain types of plants. Obviously, woody plants take a lot less work than non-woody plants. Some plants, like sort of evergreen plants that respond to clipping, only need a bout of work once or twice a year. And so you can organise your time around that. Say, okay, this weekend I'm going to do all the clipping needed or all the pruning needed, and that's it. And I don't have to touch that plant again for the rest of the year. I would give an example of that. Our pleached lime trees we have. And I'm not saying everyone's going to have pleached limes, but they just need pruning once a year. That's all we do. As you know, we have these topiary yew cones in the front. Everyone says, oh, must be so much work. It's precisely one day's work a year. We cut and clear it up in a day. That's it. We don't touch them the rest of the year. I mean, literally, don't touch them. It's the least work of all the stuff we do. And yet it looks as though it's work. You could have a garden that is largely structural, that has a lot of green, that does take, say, clipping, but you can do that in bouts when you are free and you can organise it. And usually there's a big enough window to be flexible. If you want to grow food, herbs are a lot less work than vegetables. Not all vegetables are a lot of work. You know, I mean, some are more than others. Root vegetables tend to do their stuff under the ground without too much faff or fiddling. Leaves of all kinds tend to be fairly easy and straightforward. If you're going to grow a tender vegetable, that's going to be more work than one that isn't, because you're going to have to protect it and the rest of it. So if you stick to hardy plants, ones that only need minimal human intervention in order to do what you want them to do, Now, the perfect example of that is a tree. Plant an oak tree and you probably never need to touch it ever again. You might, but you don't need to. If you're going to grow something edible, herbs are likely to be less work. But whatever it is, grow hardy. If they can be perennial, so much the better. Because, you know, you just need to plant them and there are just a few activities. So I think a bit of organisation and time can be managed. But if you've got lots of time and no money, it's much easier to garden than if you've got lots of money and no time.
Well,
other than to pay someone else.
I was just about to say that.
No, I'm going to say, but I mean, if you want to garden,
yeah,
if you want to do it yourself, all the money in the world won't buy you time.
No, no.
As I say, you know, no billionaire ever bought an extra second of time.
If you did want to do it all yourself, and I'm conscious of time because we are nearly out of it, but I know you love a bit of kit. A lovely tool, a nice ladder, a lovely pair of secateurs. If somebody is embarking on their gardening journey and they don't have one single item in their shed, what do they really need?
The first thing I'd say with all tools, particularly cutting tools, you pay for what you get. So buy the very best you can afford, whatever that means for you. Don't try and save money on cheap kit because it won't do the job. It's much more likely to damage both the plant and yourself. So buy decent kit. A spade. You absolutely need a spade. You probably need a trowel. You need a pair of secateurs. In this day and age, a small sharp saw, particularly a folding one, is likely to be more used to you than a pair of loppers, which are bulky and don't use. But I find a small foldable pocket saw, and the Japanese ones are unbelievably sharp and effective, really useful. You'll need a fork. So a spade and a fork. Again, buy not just the best you can afford, but buy ones you like.
Well, hopefully you're going to have them for a long time, aren't you?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It makes sense.
You're going to have
a
long time. You're going to want to use them. Buy things that you want to use for their own sake. When you pick it up, you think, yeah, it's like a pen. If you have a nice pen, you want to write. Or if you have a really nice saucepan, you want to cook. Whereas if you go, you know, you go on holiday and you go into the kitchen of this, you rent somewhere and they've put in their cheapest, most minimal kit in the kitchen. And so your heart sinks. So treat yourself within your own means. It's better to have less nice stuff than not. You don't need lots of different size hoes. You don't need, you know, one fork, one spade. I use the same spade all the time. As you know, I've got about 12 hanging up in the wall.
Yes.
I only ever use the same one all the time because, you know, it does everything I need. A rake is useful. A rake, a spade, a fork, a pair of secateurs, a sharp saw and a trowel. There's not much you can't do.
Great.
On a wheelbarrow. A wheelbarrow. But if you have a very small garden, these plastic trugs, which aren't beautiful, but they are very useful.
Yeah.
You know, and actually what I would say, apropos of everything I've been saying earlier, get a recycled rubber one rather than the plastic one, if you can.
Okay. I guess they're just so much more durable, aren't they, as well?
They're more durable, and very often they're made from old tyres, which is a very good way of recycling used rubber.
Great. Okay, we are nearly out of time, but I have one final question. And it almost circles back on to where we started, actually. Let's say, and I hope we've inspired people to say, do you know what? I'm going to garden. This is the year I'm going to garden. What should somebody do this weekend that will give them a result of some kind this year?
Well, the most obvious thing is simply go to a garden centre and buy some plug plants and pot up a container or two and watch them flower and they will grow. And I mean, slightly earlier, but if you get tender plants like petunias or anything like that, they will go on flowering and flowering and flowering. I think slightly more satisfactory would be buy a packet of seeds of something you like to eat. Read the instructions, follow the instructions, and when you harvest it, share it with somebody that you love.
Thanks for listening to the BBC Gardeners World magazine podcast. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts and never miss an episode. If you've enjoyed this episode, please tell others about it and rate us in your podcast provider app.